Hi, this is Devin Orlovsky, and welcome to the Rabbi Orlovsky Show. And whether you're watching with our friends over at Torah Anytime, wherever you watch or listen to your podcast, as always, it is a pleasure to have you along for this experience. And this is, of course, our special Purim edition of the Rabbi Orlovsky Show. Yeah? Shoshanas Yaakov, Solov Isamecha, Birazav Yachat, Chelez Mordechai. And we have a special sponsor for this special Purim edition of the Rabbi Orlovsky Show. Le'iloi Nishmas, well, that changed fast. Shlomo ben Avigdor Moshe Fried, Malkabas Moshe Fried, Yitzchak Yaakov ben Eliezer Grunberger, Rivka Bas Gavriel Chaim Grunberger, Zev ben Yehuda Leib Weinstein, and Refuah Shlema Temea Binyamin ben Chaya Sora, and may Hashem send Yeshuas and Nechamas to all of Klai Yisrael by Avigdor Moshe and Mindy Fried. I just, on a personal note, want to say that the Frieds are just the nicest people in the world and such good friends, and we go back many, many years, and they go back with my wife's family back to the old days in Kew Garden Hills, and Baruch Hashem, they should have only simchas and wonderful things, and their families, refuas and yeshuas. And so for our, I rack my brain. I only have one. I know it seems like I have two, but I only have one brain, and I rack it before Purim to think, what can I do that will be a very special Purim edition? And I said, I know, the return of Yaakov Orlovsky, ladies and gentlemen. You know, in the first year, I think Yaakov was our first guest, and he may have been our only guest, and he's been back several times since. He's a fan favorite of the Rabbi Orlovsky Show. He hasn't been here in a long time, and I said, my gosh, Purim is coming up. Who better than to have Yaakov? In fact, we did a Purim show twice, once in America and once during COVID, one of the most pathetic productions that we ever had. It was terrible, but I don't hold you responsible for that. That was because we were on Zoom, and we kept zooming in and out of you know, disappearing and stuff. But anyway, welcome to the show, Yaakov Orlovsky.
Thank you.
Okay, that was a great opening.
Well, I'll tell you,
that's
you
the kind of clever repartee that we're looking for on this Purim edition of the Rabbi Orlovsky.
Previous shows, you had me on, and I didn't stop talking, and then I wasn't invited back for years. So I'm going to try a different approach this time and just see how that works out. Thank you.
There was somebody who was speaking at a Malava Malka. And if you've ever been to these events, you know, this one speaks, and then this one introduces the speaker, and then this one introduces the introduction, and they speak and speak. And by the time the guest speaker got up, it was 12 o'clock at night. And he got up and he said, I was invited to be the guest speaker, but apparently I was meant to be the guest listener. Goodbye. And he sat down to tremendous applause. My friend, Rabbi Yitzchak David Frankel, who is the Rabbi of the Good of the Five Towns, who was on our show, a live podcast in New York. So he was once speaking at a bar mitzvah, and there were many, 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 many speakers. And he got up and he says, you ever see kids who say, I'm the fastest runner in the world. I can run around the entire world in a second. Watch. Want to see it again? He goes, I bet I'm the fastest speaker here tonight. Want to hear it again? Once again, the tremendous applause. So that's why, you know, I've said this, and I want this on record. I don't want any hispedim when I die, because I hate speeches. And so I just don't want to have to be there, you know, make a big shloshim and speak whatever you want. I won't be there, hopefully, you know.
Can we edit this part out?
Absolutely not. I want this on record. I hate hispedim. I don't want to be there. I don't want to listen to any speeches. Just put me in the ground as quickly as possible. Anyway, but so that's why I have to sit through speeches. So anyway, so Yaakov, what do you want to share with us as we approach Purim? We have to take Purim and make it meaningful. This is always the challenge of everything in Avodas Hashem, is to make it meaningful. So what you been doing?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Listen, I was thinking this time, I don't know if we ever done this. I don't think we did it, at least not in this way. Maybe
just sing. I did a few.
You did a few of those, yeah.
Well, we had Ezra here,
right? You literally sing the whole bench, so we could start trying to sing the Megillah. See how that goes.
There you go.
But you know, different people have different experiences on Purim. Everyone does their Purim the different way they do their Sudas, Mishloach Manos, and so on. I was thinking maybe we could share a little bit of how, you know, at least growing up, how we had our Purim over here.
Well, we're out of time. Thanks so much, everybody.
Well, we don't have to hit all the way to the end.
I have to say, I remember all the Purims except one year when...
I remember the year you don't remember.
Apparently, I got drunk. I don't remember getting drunk because I don't get drunk as a rule. And I just don't remember. And I remember they videoed it. And the kids always said to me, do you want to see the video? And I said, no, I have not seen the video to this day. But I was the only one that I don't remember. So, yeah. So
that was the one thing we had, this video camera
yeah.
that we used to video. And you could just re-see it on that little screen. Mm. And every poor morning, somehow... find yourself sleeping somewhere, and then you wake up, you know, wobbling in the morning, and right away you run to the video camera and say, okay, what'd I do last night? Oh, okay.
I remember one Purim, I woke up and found a pregnant nun sleeping on my floor.
Yeah.
So that I do remember.
He's a famous guy today.
Yeah?
Yeah, very.
All right. Well, we won't mention him by name, but...
Well, so I'll tell you, you know how... You know,
my friend, we just give you a shout out. Anyway, kidding. We're kidding. Anyway,
he's a singer, famous singer. You know how Pesach comes, people start cleaning and preparing, you know, from Tu Bishvat.
Yeah.
People clean it up. Yeah.
Sure.
Not us. I mean, we used to like, it was like a week before Pesach. And then everyone's like, oh my God, it's Pesach in a week. And then the house was a ruckus. I mean, literally till after
Bdikas Chametz. We had 11 kids. It's very hard to clean with a lot of little kids running around.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
as fast as you clean, they, you know, destroy it again. There was one year, remember? Oh gosh, we had done a particular room and then a kid walked in there with like some kind of sprinkles that were Chametz and dropped it and they rolled all over the place. And, 1 second. It's one wonder I have a heart condition. Anyway, yeah.
Well, listen, you always used to do the big sponger. You know, the big sponger. This is apparently, you know.
Now, is this room over here? You can't really see it so well. But I would get down on my hands and knees.
Yeah, but it was the whole house. Like, everyone used to clean their room. And then we used to all move out and then do the living room, dining room, whatever, all the shared rooms. And then, you know, the last day was the big sponger. I grew up with the big sponger. That was the Pesach. You take out all the drawers, move all the beds, and then just like scrubbing and doing like, okay, we're going to clean the... But then throughout my life...
Because the problem is that if when you do is the spool sponger and you don't do the other room, then it just tracks back in.
Right.
So you have to do everything at the same time. Otherwise, right. you know, so you could do the first cleaning, but the...
Right. So this is what I thought, that, you know, this is the only way to do it, the big sponger. Later on in life, you know, especially when I was married, and then Pesach comes, and my wife is, you know, super extra clean and neat and stuff like that. Like, yeah, I don't know how much you even have to clean for Pesach, but okay, fine, we do the whole cleaning. And then I'm like, I don't know if we have time. We have to do the big sponger. She's like, what's the big sponger? I was like, what? Got to move everything and then just flood the house all at the same time and get down and scrub and stuff. And she looks at me like I'm crazy. She's like, everything's clean. What are you doing? I was like, no. This is pain. You got to do the big sponger. Where are we on the big sponger? So apparently that's not universal.
Yeah.
The big sponger.
There's a lot of things I found that are not universal. So like, for example, not everybody washes all the windows.
For Pesach or just in general?
For Pesach.
Okay.
Because apparently you almost never find a Gluska Yuffa stuck on the window itself. However, I have found them on the Trissom. So that for sure you have to do. Yeah. Well, I had a different standard. In fact, when I was growing up, I remember we would have, to me, I don't mind making Pesach. I don't mind the cleaning. I don't mind the cooking, the shopping. That I mind switching back.
Oh.
That to me is a nightmare.
That's terrible.
That is absolutely a nightmare. But when I was growing up, and I was a teenager, and I was an FBT, a flaming Baal Tshuva. So my father would motzi yantif, you know, have some matzah and whatever and a cup of coffee, you know. And then he'd say to me, well, good night. I'm having chametz in the morning. And I would stay up all night, you know, packing everything up, taking everything, washing everything, you know, and everything. There's a system to winding down, which my family did not understand. You know, there shouldn't be any pots in the fridge by this point. Yeah. They should have switched into chad pami. They should have, forget about it.
Well, I know a guy like that, that what he does is, you know, Erev Shvi, they already do all the dishes. Well, because one of the hardest parts is that then you had a day yontif or 2 day yontif, you know, wherever you are in the world. And then you have all the dishes and all the pots and everything you used. Then you have to wash it and you're just waiting for it till it dries. You have to dry everything. It's like a double job. So he, you know, Erev Shvi, they do all the dishes and everything like that. They try to cook whatever they could just in, you know, pans in the oven. And then everything's dry. They just use, you know, like you said, chad pami or whatever, you know, paper goods and so on.
Yeah.
And by the time it comes in, then that whole part is done.
Yeah. So my house, we didn't do that. So it was up to me all night, going way into early in the morning. So I knew my father was serious. He was going to come in and have chametz in the morning in the kitchen. In fact, I had these, my parents, my father grew up very poor. And the only Yerusha he had from his mother were these two plates that he got in a five and dime store, you know, his mother. They were offset printed, you know, and they were like a little blurry, you know. One was matzah and one was the Seder plate. And that was his Yerusha from his mother. And we used to have to carry it up from the Pesach closet. And it was understood. It was never stated, but it was understood that if you broke those plates, you don't have to explain. Just leave. Just go. Pack up whatever you can and get out, because that's it. That was all he had, you know, right there, you know? So that was a pachad all by itself, you know? So as the years went by, we rubbed it in bubble wrap and cardboard and stuff. But every time we carried it up there, shit, Marsha, the Kohen Gadol and Yom Kippur going into the Kosher Kadosh with a rope tied around him in case he died, you know? Anyway.
So the reason I mentioned this is because that Pesach, we couldn't start, you know, so in advance, but Purim started by us like 2 months in advance, at least. You know, first you got to decide a theme, and then you would have the family discussions about the themes of Purim. Everything was a theme by us.
And this was hard because if it wasn't like the theme, then nobody was happy, and you had to keep rethinking it and replanning it. Then
exactly.
So far, no one has done my theme that I've always wanted to do.
Right.
The carrots.
Yeah.
I wanted to start collecting carrot bags and then put the shalach matzahs in carrot bags and have everything based on carrots and then have everyone dress up with carrots. And it still hasn't happened. One day. One day, Mitz Hashem. Now that everyone's out of the house, it's just us and Shlomo. So, you know, he'll, when he moves out, so then we could do carrots, me and Ima.
Yeah, that sounds like a fun Purim.
There you go.
Well, so the first themes that were just, you know, based on ideas or twists with the name or stuff like that. Eventually, after a bunch of years, you know, you run out of the themes and then just went into color schemes and stuff like that. And you basically did all the colors. And I mean, what's left? Well, I mean, besides the carrot bag, it's starting not to look so bad.
One year we had a Purim Mishulish, and we did threes. Everything was in threes.
Right.
So that was exciting. And I remember at one point, Eged was advertising that they changed all the color of their buses to green. And Yerok Zeh Eged. So they, and they had that big Aleph. So they did an Aleph for Orlovsky. Now, Yerok Zeh Orlovsky. And we did that for him.
Right, you know? With all the green stuff.
Yeah, that was the last one.
All right, so it starts with a theme, right? You got to do the theme. Then you got to figure out the shalach monas that always has to go with the theme.
Yes.
All right. And then you always write some sort of letter slash poem, whatever.
Now, I have to say, this is an art form. Because, you know, most of the poems that you get in the shalach monas, people don't have a gift for it. They really should just write... From the You know?
Exactly. That's what I don't even do from. I just write my last name. That's it. Mishpachat, and then you're done.
I don't even write my name. This way, they're just going to hand it to somebody else.
Exactly.
Anyway.
So who knows where it's going to go, right?
I've
just
had this,
happy Purim, and just let it go.
You send the Shalachmanas, and then you get it back from like five people later. You know, you save Shalachmanas, which is great because I like mine better. The, you know. But
and you're always left with so much. Like when I was younger, you used to make like 100 of them.
Yeah.
The whole living room was filled with whatever you were.
Well, I've worked hard to alienate most of the people in my life, so there are many much less people to send it to. But of course, you end up with less shalachmanas, you know.
Yeah.
But
so lots and lots of them. You're always left with a ton of stuff. All the shalachmanas stuff you get from people, and then all the stuff you had that, you know, you have left. And at the end of the kitchen, it was just like piles and piles of this stuff. And we're always hoping that maybe one of the, you know, organizations that collect money, you know, food for the poor will come and like, but you know, they don't always want all the chametz. And then you're just left with piles and piles of them.
There was a guy, Kramer, who does brisim.
Yeah, of course, for older.
He does it for adults.
Yeah.
Does it for adults. The first time I met him is you have a lot of people from the former Soviet Union who didn't have brisim. And so he does it for them. And when you reach a certain age, you can't sit on someone's lap. You know, you have to have like a what do you call it? A operating room, you know, and doctors and stuff. And so so I paid for a bris once, a whole bris. And so he made me a sandik. And it's amazing. You scrub up, you wear the scrubs, and you hold the head as they're doing it. And he used to come by after Purim and collect all the little bottles of wine.
Oh.
Because after the brisim, he would make like a, you know.
Wow.
I went to this one, you know, he's a Hasidish, so afterwards you have a Suda and you have a Rakida.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very slow Rakida. As you can probably imagine. When I was there, the youngest one kid who was getting it was 15. The oldest was a man who was 76.
Wow.
Had a bris milah.
Wow.
They all seemed pretty happy.
It's amazing.
They were dancing pretty slowly.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. So they used to take that. I have. Okay. I don't pretend that I, you know, about my background. But I grew up in a conservative household, and we went trick or treating. It's hard to do here in Eretz Yisrael. I think maybe you could do it in Machal and Malo Dafna and, you know, and Ramadishko. They wouldn't be surprised that you showed up on Halloween and to trick or treat, you know, give you something. But and when I was growing up, we used to do it. And my grandmother, my mother's mother, would come by after Halloween and steal all our candy and take it to the hospital, give the sick children. We had to, like, try to
really?
Hide it. Yeah, we had to hide it.
Wow.
And my attitude was like, charity begins at home, but my grandma took all my stuff, you know, we had to like try to hide. Anyway, but so by Purim, you remember what we used to do at the end of Purim?
Well, whoever was still around.
Whoever was still around.
We opened the shalachmanos.
We wouldn't let anyone eat. You know how people start, now I can't do this anymore because as soon as the shalachmanos comes, people start right away munching at it and taking
it.
Yeah,
well, there's all the grandkids and stuff. It's
not just the grandkids. It's the children now have no respect for tradition. But I used to put everything in the back of the kitchen. You weren't allowed to touch it. And when the whole suda was over and we cleaned up, we would take out all the shalachmanos and we would learn pshat.
Yeah.
We would say, what were these people trying to say? And and, you know, what was their theme and what they're trying to do here? You know what I mean? You know, and so, like, you have the people who, like, do the, you know, the orange with the, like, little piece of bumba for a mouth and, like, two little toffees and stuff.
And the two long pretzels.
What these people are saying is that they really don't care about you. You're just not that important. You really should cultivate better friends. I still remember, give them a shout out, the Tenches. They used to send for shalachmanos like sliced roast beef.
Yeah.
And
by the way, those
if you're
those
out there,
sandwiches?
We still love you and we'd love to get a shalachmanos. Those are the kind of friends you need to cultivate, the roast beef people, and try to squeeze out the bumba bizzly people.
Yeah, but listen, the best were those sandwiches. People would just come by with like some sort of sandwiches, you know. Or breakfast type thing that they
come
in.
Yeah, but you have to eat it right away.
Right, but you know what? Purim is like that because you go to the Megillah and then you start your shalachmanos all day. Whenever the suda is, by us was usually always at the end of the day. And somehow you got to just figure out food throughout the day. but you're not making anything. You're not cooking anything. And then, I mean, what are you going to eat? I mean, you're just drinking and you got to eat something. And the shalchmonas come in.
My son-in-law, Yisrael Meir, for reasons that are unclear to me, people go crazy over his cold cut sandwiches.
Very good.
I don't know what, but it's Israeli cold cuts. What can you do with
it? I mean, you don't need a lot. A nice fresh roll.
But he takes like a baguette and he slices it and he has
some ketchup, some sauces. Mustard,
I don't know if he puts some cold. I don't know.
He does that. The two and types, he slices salami, them
up,
turkey,
and people go crazy pickles. Over it. They just eat it all up, you know?
I mean, but what else do you need? A nice fresh roll, you know, with some sauce, a little whatever, that fake meat that they put in there, you know, some pickles. I mean, this is not American cold cuts. This is
alternatively roast beef.
Yeah.
I think it makes a fine snack treat.
Yes.
And then there are people who send the breakfast and they have like, you know, yogurt and granola and those kind of things. And,
right.
You know, sometimes you actually get like bagels and
right.
You know, cream cheese and stuff. You know, very exciting.
Chocolate, all the chocolate.
So somebody once comes, his wife was learning how to do chocolate. And he brings by a shalchmonas and it's all these very fancy, like, you know, chocolate things for him. That I go, wow, this is unbelievable. And I ate one and he almost had a heart attack. I don't think he planned on anyone actually eating it. He just wants to put it on display, you know? So anyway, but we would sit down and we would put it out. So, you know, you'd say, okay, well, cans go over here.
Yeah.
Bottles go over here, you know.
Boxes of Bamba and Bisley and stuff. You know, those kind of
things. There were boxes. And then there's all like the loose nuts, you know. Now, you don't know where they've been and who packed this.
Well, listen, this is true about almost everything.
E. coli, you know what I mean?
People send baked goods and stuff, you know. But if you don't like personally know them, I mean, you know.
Right.
What if, you know, some, you know, little kids were, you know, dirty little kids. I mean, I don't mean that in like a bad way, but yeah, exactly. You know,
when kids come home from like a baking hood.
Right, exactly. Like, you want it to hear. Right here. He's like, here, digging taste this.
Digging into the dough.
Right. And I'm like, no.
There was a Seinfeld like that once where he's in an Italian restaurant and the chef goes to the bathroom and doesn't wash his hands afterwards. And he sees him like, kneading the dough. Pizza. I'm not so hungry. Yeah, it is a problem whenever like the little kids bake a challah and they bring it home and they say, oh, I made this myself. And, yeah. Let me take some antibiotics first. Just to be on the safe side.
Well, and then there's the whole costume. So when everyone was older and stuff, then we try to do like family costumes. So we're certain kind of ideas now. Being the only boys, you know, they usually did all the girls, and then we could just get away with like just putting on a mask or, you know, a funny tie or something like that.
Yeah.
And throughout the years, it got bigger. But when we were younger, I mean,
I had this great idea of wearing like a black suit. A white shirt and a black tie, and going as a Mormon. How about that?
At a funeral.
That's how the Mormons dress. Yeah. So.
But listen, when we were younger, I mean, that was a lot of kids.
Yeah.
Everyone has to do a school costume, but then the day costume.
Oh, and sometimes at school there's like two of them.
Right.
There's one for the party, and then there's one for the thing, and then there's for the day and the night. And it's, you can go crazy.
Yeah. But so. you did it.
You have kids now.
Yeah, but, you know.
I write them online?
Yeah, usually. I mean, it's simpler. Comes to the house. They're excited for a day. It's a buck and a half, and you know what I mean? It is what it is. I mean, when we were very little.
Buck and a half? You can get a costume for a buck and a half.
No. I mean to say it's, like, expensive. Just the figure of speech.
You used to get these costumes. They were, like, expensive.
Yeah, they are.
$30.
Yeah, and I mean, it's like a one-time use. I mean,
yeah, because no one was using it. Yeah.
Exactly. So if there's cousins and, you know, other kids, you could try to, you know, but when we were very little, you guys used to be creative with the costumes, try to set us up, you know, with some. Yeah,
go ahead. You're still traumatized.
No,
tell the story.
No,
tell the story.
If
tell
you
the story.
I wasn't talking about me. I'm not talking about me. I'm just saying.
Yaakov was three. You might have been two. You might have been two. I don't know what it was. You were going to...
Six. I was six.
You were not. You were okay,
I don't know. There's a picture somewhere.
I don't know. You were either two or three. And you were going again. And so he was like, you know, okay. Like, you know, it's going to gun. So she took a red jogging suit, which she thought looked royal. And she took an apron tied around your neck like a cape and made one of those little crowns out of aluminum foil. And put on makeup, you know, and that's it. Mordechai, you think? Oh, and a charvit made out of aluminum foil. and the little tender pulls up, and every kid is dressed like from the cast of a Hollywood, historical drama. And your mouth just drops open. So you came home, and you said, so how was it? He goes, oh, very nice. This one was... You know, this one was Haman, and this one was a clown, and this one was... Yeah. He goes, and you were Mordechai Yehudi? He goes, no. Kivi was Mordechai Yehudi. He goes, well, what were you? I was just nothing. And the trauma remains to this day. So.
Well, there's like a class porn picture there that we had. And you see them all and the stuff, and I'm just sitting there with my shirt down, just looking down.
But it's totally out of control.
It is. It's crazy. It's just crazy. And if you have a lot of kids and, you know.
Yerushalmis. You know what Yerushalmis do? They put on a Turkish fez. Yeah. That's it. That's what they do.
That's funny. That's a funny Purim costume.
Probably goes back to when the Turks were here. So to them that was.
Yeah.
That was.
Some of them are still living in that era.
It was in vogue back then, you know.
So. You have the costumes and, all right, this is preparation, right? Now, you live in Yerushalayim, so the fast doesn't fall right into Purim.
That's the best thing.
Yeah.
Best thing about living in Yerushalayim.
Right. The first thing when I moved out, I live in Beit Shemesh, right? The hardest part on Purim was that.
Because you go straight from the tinus into
exactly. And like,
and it's not like when I was growing up where kids had these little groggers. Now they have these gigantic 4-foot groggers, and they've got air horns, and they shoot all the cap guns. And
military
smoke,
grade explosives,
you know, M16s.
I mean, yeah.
So halfway through, you don't care about Haman. You want to kill that kid over there.
Now, to be honest, as a kid,
and your head is killing. So
as a kid, I used to be that kid. I mean, we used to bring pots and pans and. Just bang on stuff you bought us one time, you know what I mean? Different kind of like
musical
noise, right? Yeah. To bring up to the Megillah and stuff. And I mean, you can't just sit in the living room and like take the pong. I mean, you know, so they're at the shul, you know, you're just a kid, you're just doing the noise and people want to kill you. Yeah. Yeah, but
at least it's better. You're not going from a tinnitus, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's rough. That's rough. Right. And I feel like you have that extra day because if it's not Purim yet, then you have life and everything, you know, goes on regular. And then you just, okay, it's Purim right away. And you got to get, you know, here, you had the extra day.
I still cannot comprehend that on Shushan Purim, this is the only place we're doing Purim. Like, to me, it feels like this is Purim for everybody. And on regular Purim, when the whole world is celebrating Purim, to me, it's nothing.
Right.
I just don't even understand how that works.
Right.
So, I can't think of any other time when it's like this, you know?
But because you're supposed to have some sort of like suda ready at nighttime.
Well, we're good at that.
Right.
We always have some kind of suda.
Right. Well, I'm saying when I was, my whole childhood, there was, you always just take short ribs.
Yeah.
Glazed with like honey and stuff, like a sweet whatever. Used to cook it for hours in the oven. And then used to just.
Day ribs.
Yeah. And we used to just demolish it. Just the me and you.
The same Shemaiah.
Yeah, you know, for sure. I mean, yeah. I mean, that's
not
the
because
mitzvah.
I wanted to eat. The
yeah,
spirits.
No. I mean, I wanted to be milchig. I mean, who even wanted to eat the meat? But you know,
well, cottage cheese and a tomato.
Yeah. What else? What else does one need? You know.
I said that once to Yerushalmi. You know, I said, how do you? You know, I said, what are you living on? You know what I mean? He adds up the money. I says, no money there. You know. I said, yeah, because to you, supper is like, you know, a piece of bread and, you know, tomato and cottage cheese. He says, cottage cheese? Who can afford cottage cheese? Tomato and a piece of bread, a little butter, you know, I'm fine. Cottage cheese. What am I, a gevir? It's a different thing, you know.
Hey.
When we first moved here, the Israeli invited us over for supper. And the main course was petitim, which for those of you in America is orzo. And our kids were like, where's the food? What is this? Israelis do a big lunch and they don't do a supper. So
it's like a Shragi story when he went to Shabbos to the...
We have a cousin, Shragi Klughaupt, and he was invited to a family in Mei Sharm for Suda. And they put out the bread and put out the dips and they put the fish. And says, you want another piece of fish? He says, oh, I'm leaving room for the main course. Everyone goes, you know, I will have another piece of fish. But that's okay because, you know, I had a nutritionist, one of my nutritionists that I went through. She says, I don't understand you from people. What you're even thinking? Says, you sit down, you have bread, and you have all the dips and the salads. That's called a meal. I remember when I was here, you go out to a falafel store, you got a hummus plate.
Yes.
Hummus, a couple of falafel bowls and that. And
till today, by the way, this is
that's
common
a suda. That's a suda. So you just ate a meal. Then you bring out the fish and the soup. That's another meal. Then you bring out the main course and the side dish. That's another meal. Then the amount of calories in the dessert and the bread. You eat four meals on a Friday night. So,
yeah, but I'll tell you something. You know, I've seen my share of fitness experts and so on. You know, but the majority of them that I went to, they're humongous. They're huge people. And it's just very hard to accept, you know, from someone like that who comes and tells you, listen, you're really fat. You got to do a diet. You know what I mean? Eat whatever, half a yogurt, some popcorn and whole wheat bread and whatever. And like, I'm like, what do you eat? I mean, you know.
I'll have what he's having.
Yeah, half of that. I mean, that's not genuine.
That's your Uncle Jason's story, you know, when he, after one of his heart attacks. So he had to lose weight in order to get the heart transplant. That was the one to get onto the list.
He did. He lost a lot of weight.
Yeah. So he went to the first nutritionist and she was very heavy. So he says, you have nothing to tell me. And he walked out. Then he goes to the next one and she was really skinny. And he says, you have no idea where I'm coming from. Why should I waste my time listening to you? He says, I was heavy. I lost the weight. Mm. I said, I come from a very heavy family. I've been watching myself my whole life.
Wow.
He says, okay, talk.
Yeah.
That's how it goes.
Yeah.
But listen, I don't necessarily understand that. Because someone could be good at what they do, even though they're... My friend, Rabbi Rudman, told me that when his brother was in medical school, the guy who was teaching about lung cancer was a chain smoker. And he's sitting there, puffing away, going, look at the x-ray. You can see the diseased lungs coming from the smoking. So a person could know it.
Yeah, no. I'm not saying that they're necessarily wrong. It's just a little harder to accept, you know?
Yeah, I guess.
Especially when they call you huge, you know? Personal experience.
When you broke your toe that time. So I said, I know already what the doctor's going to say. He says, no matter what you're doing, whenever you go to, when you're really heavy and you go to the doctor, it doesn't matter what you're coming in for, you know, strep throat, you know, he goes, well, you know what your problem is? You need to lose weight, you know? So one time I go in and they say, well, you know what the problem is? I said, I'm not getting enough red meat. No, that's not the problem. So you were outside when you had a broken toe, you know.
Well, it was in the pool. I was kicking whatever and I ended up kicking the metal ladder going up and I broke one of my toes, yeah.
So I was telling you this story. So we go into the doctor and sure enough, he says, well, you know what your problem is? And you just burst out laughing. It was, it's not funny.
It is to me.
Yeah, well, I didn't prepare you well for life. Anyway. But it used to be a lot different when I had jobs because I had students.
Right, well, but till today this happens. So I didn't get to the day. So nighttime, right, you do the Megillah, right? So you're not coming in out of a fast.
Right.
Right, so, and a lot of, like, your Megillah is very different than the rest of the world because they had a day of Purim. And somehow, whoever can, somehow streams into Yerushalayim on Purim.
I don't get it.
Okay.
People want 2 days of Purim.
Yeah. I know people who say, like, could I be somewhere and then drive somewhere else and try to miss the port?
Yeah, you know? That's right.
Yeah.
To me, it's like stay in Yerushalayim and then just before Shkia, drive to Beit Shemesh and stay there, and then you can miss Purim altogether. You know, I hear that more than having 2 days of Purim. You know, but that's what they have. A lot of people in Yerushalayim, they go to
Beit Brak and stuff. So your Megillah reading is different. The experience is different. A lot of people are coming in already drunk, you know, already after a whole day of Purim, right? That's different by us. No one's coming in drunk, or hopefully not, right, to the rest of the world's Megillah. So the nighttime is usually, starts off calm, not so much by you guys. And you always had your Megillah.
Yeah, my grandfather's Megillah.
Yeah.
At least that's what my father told me.
Mm-hmm.
He says it's his grandfather's Megillah. And I would take that along with me. Old Megillah.
Very old. Patched up a few times. Yeah. All right, good. And that was on a serious note.
Because one of the little pieces fell off. So I have a hole in it now.
Now still?
Well, it was all patched up, but then one of the patches fell off. So I have to
fix
it back on, yeah. Anyway.
Right. All right. And then, I mean, that basically sums it up. And then we're finishing up the Shalach Monas. Preparing them, right? Okay. The morning, are you an early davening guy, a late davening guy?
Early.
Every day?
Not of a seeking.
Okay.
Not of a seeking, but I if you go to a late Megillah reading, then your day is half over by the time you get home, you know? And they have all those, you have all those Shalach Monos already outside your door, you know, when you're leaving to go to Megillah reading, you know? And then you have to track the people down to give them a Shalach Monos, whereas if they come to the door, you can quickly do the switch, you know?
Well, you believe in that? If someone gives you a Shalach Monos, you have to give them back?
You don't have to.
Right.
But it is, you know, expected.
And what if you were not prepared?
Like the Gemara says, by the gifts you give to the Chosin,
yeah.
You know, that whatever you give, if the guy doesn't give you back, you could even be toying him and based in because, you know, expect to do it. But my parents, when we had a bar mitzvah or something, they would keep a list of the gifts, you know, based on, and that they would know how much to give when they went to their bar mitzvah. That's how we did it. And then if somebody didn't keep up, you know.
All right, but if someone comes and you're not prepared, you didn't think, it wasn't on your list, what do you do then?
I always make some extras.
Okay, 5 people came in, 10 extra people.
Right. So once upon a time, that was a problem. So then you make a quickie, you know, you pull some stuff together, you know, and, you know, hand them the garbage, say, you're going to take this out with you. Drop it on the way out. So, you can put something together. I mean, then you make a zombie Shalach Monos, you know, where you raid other people's Shalach Monos and stick things together. And,
right.
But they see it's not the theme.
Right. I mean, obviously they know, so...
There was a time, like you said, when we used to make like 60 Shalach Monos, but you know, now we're down to about 4. We managed to alienate just about everybody in our lives, and so not a problem.
Yeah, moving right along. So then you come back from davening and whatever. Okay, the Shalach Monos, whatever, starts. Now, the way you always had it here, it was took out whatever alcohol you went around. Just set the table. And then slowly throughout the day, you would have like groups and groups of students coming by.
Yeah, that's when I had students.
Yeah. But that still happens today when I see you on Purim.
Nah.
Not so much?
No. Well, you know, I've never been a big fan of the tatim, you know, come around collecting. So.
So you let them know.
You were the bouncer.
Well, I mean, listen, sometimes you would let them know fearfully exactly
when people come
how
in like
you
a mensch
about it.
And they want to collect and they tell you what it is and they sit down like you mentioned. Okay. But when they come in and do the drunk routine, you know, now some of them, it's not a routine, you know, and they come in, they're spilling stuff and that. I said, get out of my house. This is not... You want me to give you money, Ki'ilu, you b'nei Torah, when you acted like animals? What? I don't give money to animals. You know, here's some oats and get out. So, okay. Part of it is I'm a cranky old man. That's part of it. And I always was, even when I was young, you know. But part of it is, don't come in here and act like a bunch of behemoths and then expect that I should give you stalker. It's not stalker, you know. So there are guys who come in, like mentioned. Sometimes they dance a little bit, you know. Sometimes they just sit down and say over Dvar Torah. You know, okay, that's menschlich. I understand that, you know. Your cousin Aaron would have a board where he'd put down money and then you get to spin. And if it's a certain number, then he'll double it. And if not, then you lose it, you know. Like they're on the phone with the Rashi. He goes, I don't know, what should I do? What should I do? Should I spin? Do I not? This is what he's giving me. You know, goes, the Rashi was like, oh, I spin, I'll say a capital deal.
Well, what happened was with that story, I think the whole yeshiva came to him. And then he basically let every kid spin. And then whatever that came out. And then he told them, you have one spin. Two dice, if you get, I think, over under a five or whatever, you lose it. 5, 6, 7, it stays. Eight. And then higher than that, I double it. And I think then it was a large amount. And what happened was with that story, if I remember correctly, they asked the Shiva, it was a whole story back and forth. And then he said, fine, just someone should spin it. And he spun it and he got a 3. And he lost the whole thing. And first he's like, oh, that's it, it's over, and whatever, it was a whole total. Then he ended up giving him the double anyway.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. That this is how the story goes. I don't know. I wasn't there, but this is the story. But they said to roll and they lost everything.
I was by one of my big thrills, and I would take you sometimes. I go to Moshe Shapiro.
Yeah, every Purim.
And he, of course, he had a whole tish going there, and he had nuts and garinim on the table, which is a minig, because Esther only ate nuts and garinim. She said she was a vegetarian, and so that's all that she ate because she didn't want to have any treif. And so he would have all that out, have the different bottles and things like that. Remember one year I came back, I had bought on the plane, they had a Johnny Walker Blue.
It was a blue label, yeah. I was there.
You were there?
Yeah.
I bring it in, and I was like, whoa. Okay, it's for Misha, for him, you know. He opens it up, he pours it for everybody, L'chaim, and everybody at the same time goes, I don't get it. Everybody was like, well, why is this so much money? This is terrible. That alone was worth it. The money was worth it just for that reaction. You know, it's like, what is this? You know?
Hey.
So, yeah, but I would go to Rav Moshe so one time a tat came in.
Yep, I was there.
Yeah. And he says, Ze minag maguna ad ma'od. Just get out. So they were Israelis and they fought with him.
Yeah,
and
but he ended up giving them money.
Of course he did.
Yeah.
So after they left, I said, if those were Amerikayim, they would have just crawled out. They would just slunk out of the door. Because Mzayo Amerikayim, lo asiti it. Because Israelis, you know, yeah, they come in with this azus, you know what I mean? So.
Well, if I remember, I think he was saying that it's not mitzvah sayom. He says,
that's what he says. He says,
the poor people.
He says, this is matanis of yonim. This is, you know, he says, so when should we come? Tell me when I'll come back.
Take the money and never come back. Yeah. Here you go. Goodbye.
And he gave like, it's like 50 or 200. I remember. It was like a respectable amount. And I was like,
yeah.
This is after yelled at him and said, this is a terrible minig and I want no part of it. And then, okay, here's the money.
He was special.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Purim was, and Purim you can get away with stuff.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes. Ami Cohen told me that one year he dressed up like Rafutna and he was not happy. Maisha didn't think it was funny, you know. Another time, my friend Zave told me that he did something. I won't go into the specifics. Maisha says, I'll tell you, damn, as a ghoul. I'll tell you, damn, as a overla ghoul. But otherwise, you can ask him stuff and, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I remember one year he says to me, David, ain't lecha shum kvetch? Nothing to complain about. So I started on something and he got all upset. And I said, oh, Baruch Hashem, I'm using my Torah, like I'm angry again. it was amazing. So Rabbi Nisso, who was just on the podcast, you know, he says very much, he goes, I don't know, he doesn't like Purim, you know. He doesn't think it's funny. He goes, that's because he understands what Purim's really all about, you know.
Yeah.
You know, the Gemara gives three reasons why we don't say Hallel on Purim. One is it was outside of Yitzhak. So one reason is the Megillah is the Hallel. The third answer is because it's not such a happy holiday. When it opens, the Beis Hamikdash is destroyed, and the Jews are in Gullus, and the evil King Achshavosh is in charge. And when the story ends, that's all the same. So that's not what we usually call Geula. Oh, so we didn't get killed, which is a good thing. Don't get me wrong on that, but it's not a real Geula the way we think of a Geula, you know. And that's why it's seeing HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the darkness. I really have to mention this because in the matziv that we're in right now, after all these terrible tragedies and the war and everything that's going on, you know, people wonder, how do you do Purim? But that's what Purim is. Purim is finding the simcha in the darkness and the hest upon him of a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Haste haste uponai. And that's what Purim is. So even in the bad times, that's when you have to be able to find a Kodesh Baruch Hu in the darkness. So I was just to kill the entire mood, but I know people wonder about this. I remember there was one year, my friend Y.Y. Rubenstein, who was also on one of our live shows, in Yerushalayim, this was during Rabin, when he was prime minister, the 18 bus blew up on a Sunday morning. And horrible thing, a bunch of people were killed. And so the right wing said, that's because you didn't close the shtachim. So they closed the shtachim. Next Sunday morning on the 18th bus, somebody blows themselves up. They said, well, that's Yerushalayim. The next week on Tainus Esther, a guy blows himself up in a mall in Tel Aviv. A whole bunch of kids in their costumes are killed. And there was a whole question, should we have Purim or not? And he was, at the time, he was in Manchester in the university, and he came in, you know, all Purim dick. And he says, that is Purim. Purim is when it doesn't make any sense, when you see all the tragedies, to be able to find HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that's what Purim's all about. So, Dafka, in a year like this, when the enemies of Israel are working so hard to try to destroy us, that's the time that we have to find the simcha in the darkness. Okay, just thought I'd throw that in. Okay, Kaddish, he's Gadol.
Timing, it's all about the timing. I mean, you had all the podcasts for this, and this, all right, I'm just saying, okay, listen, it's your podcast.
Anyway, we got to Rimash in the afternoon. That was.
By the way, he called me, Rabbi Nissel, before he published the book,
yeah,
because he wanted some stories. But I told him, like, the stories he knows, yeah, everyone knows, but there's some of them I can't tell.
Right.
Like, I don't, you know, it's not my place to publish them.
Well, I always say, over, I say, you know, Ramesha said this to me, I believe in confidence, so let me share it. He should have known better. To tell me something in confidence, like, what did you think, you know? So yeah. Reminds me,
very special.
There was this Australian comic had a film called Crocodile Dundee, and he comes to New York, and the person who's taking care of him says, I have to go to my analyst. I said, well, what's that? He goes, what, somebody can tell you problems to so you feel better. He goes, oh, you mean like Mike? Who's Mike? Oh, Mike runs the general store, and if you have anything embarrassing or that you feel bad about, you tell Mike, and Mike tells everybody else, and then you don't feel embarrassed anymore because everyone knows about it. So if you want to share something with me in confidence, you know, I do this sometimes when I'm speaking. I say, you know, so-and-so who's running the event told me something in confidence. I'd like to share it with everybody right now.
Anyway. No, I don't think he would have a problem to say, you know what I mean? I don't know. I don't know.
Because he was...
We were there. He told us stuff, you know, when we were there.
He didn't want this stuff.
I assume not, because no one else. He didn't say it to anybody else that I know, unless everyone knows.
Somebody snuck in once to ask him a question. And they had a recorder, and they recorded him, and then they opened a police investigation against him. You know,
yeah, terrible.
So, and also with Ramesha, there was nuance. And so when he said something, you had to understand what he meant.
Yeah.
You know, and you couldn't just take the words at face value. You know, you had to learn pshat, you know. I heard a story from Ami Cohen, David Cohen's son. And he said that when Rav Soloveitchik gave the first Gemara Shir to women in Stern College, so there was a meeting of the Gedolei Torah, and they were like, "What do we do about this?" So they said to Rav Moshe Feinstein, "Says you're his cousin. Call him up." So he calls him up, comes back and says, "He says he didn't do it." So Hutna says, if a man like that says he didn't do it, you machuiv to believe him. Oh, but what do we do with the picture in the Allgemeine Journal? So he asks this Rabbi Meiselman, Rashiva Teres Moshe,
his nephew.
Yeah. No. He says, you don't understand the Rav. That wasn't a Gemara Shir. Why? Because they were all sitting with Gemaras and he was explaining, right? That's not called a Gemara Shir. If you understand what a Gemara Shir is, then you would understand that wasn't a Gemara Shir, you know? So you know, you have to learn pshat sometimes, you know. So Rav Moshe would say certain things, and you had to understand. You know, there were times that he would say something, and it wasn't totally clear. And people would ask him, and he'd say, "Ma tem yiladim ktanim ani tzrich lasbir." You know, you can't figure this out for yourself. He was very much in. You know, I gave you the insight. This now work it out. You know.
Yeah.
So. So there was one time after a shir, people were saying something. I said, I don't think that's what he meant, you know. But yeah, that's what he meant. So I go up to him and I said, you know, there are people saying this. Whoever those people are, tell them they have no shaykhs to learning. They shouldn't be in the shaykh. Because listen, I'm still in trouble for when you sent me after somebody. I'm not doing nothing over here. I'm bagging. You want to say something, you do it yourself. I've gotten into enough trouble with you already.
Send the next guy.
That's right. I'm AWOL. I'll never forget when I had been teaching in Eshet Torah, and then when I moved over to Eretz Yisrael. So one time they had me speaking to a group at night, and I'm coming in. It was a Motzi Shabbos, pretty late, and Reb Noach is coming up the stairs. He says to me, "In my book, you're AWOL." I said, "It's 10 o'clock at night on a Motzi Shabbos. I'm coming here to speak in your yeshiva. What are you talking about?" I didn't know what to say. But you mentioned AWOL. So anyway, so then Purim, so we used to have people come by. Have people come by. You know?
Yeah.
I have the Talmidot when I used to teach. I used to teach in seminaries and yeshivas, and you know, I had the boys for the Suda. And I had it was one year when I was teaching in seminary, and like 30 seminary girls wanted to come for the, you know, each one called separately. And we were young then. We were like, sure. We set up tables and tables and tables. And we just spent the whole time running around serving, you know. And one by one, the girls all left because it's boring. Well, of course it's boring. You're all just sitting here and I'm running around serving your food. So like, you know, what were you expecting exactly, you know? But the guys know how to have more fun. So.
Well, I mean, when we were younger, we used to go at night and we used to do the Purim spiel in every place you were at. You're a big Purim spiel guy.
I still believe in it.
Yeah.
I when I was teaching in Eretz Yisrael, a guy said to me, "Listen, they want me to be in the Purim spiel, but I'm going to miss time for learning." You know, I said, "I think the Purim spiel is one of the most important things in the yeshiva because number one, it creates the Achdus, and with Achdus comes more Torah." That's Rav Chaim Shmulevitz. Where it says, why was there a greater Kabbalah Torah at Purim? Because there was a greater Achdus. And since the Chaim HaKadosh says there are three requirements to be able to be Mekabel Torah, one of them is Achdus. If there's more Achdus, there's more Kabbalah Torah. I said, so first of all, you'll have more learning if there's more Achdus in yeshiva. I said, second of all, it's the only way to say things in yeshiva that have to be said that you can't say normally. But you can do it in a Purim spiel, you know. There's opportunity for social critique that you otherwise wouldn't be able to do.
Yeah.
And I'm a big believer in that. I have this dream one day maybe I'll do it, to do a Permspiel in Jerusalem, you know, in one of these, you know, theaters that they have, you know, where they put on the performances and stuff and do a real performance. But I'm in Otzlin, but I'm constantly thinking up new scenes and new things to make fun of. And it would be such a, in the terms of social commentators, it's like the Kichels. The Kichels is the, by the way, they quoted me because I spoke about it on the, in the second edition of their collection. And they can say things that nobody else can say because they're comic strip characters and it's a joke. But you can, mamish, get in all the stuff that you otherwise can't say. And because it's funny, you know, it's a joke. They're just joking, you know, and then you can. So that is the power of Leitzanis when it's used for the right purpose. So that's why Permspiel was always a very important thing. And it's almost impossible to impersonate me. And it was only one guy who came close, right? My friend Mendel Berlin, who, of course, puts out the Torah Sweets Parsha sheet, you know, and has been a sponsor here. And he did me one year. It was
very good.
It was very good.
Yeah.
Very close.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Listen.
It's not like, you know, but I'm hard to do.
Yeah, but even like Trump, you know how many videos out there people impersonating him? How many of them are like really exact?
Two.
Yeah, right. So
two that I've seen that are just absolutely perfect. Yeah. Just perfect.
Yeah.
Because to do an impersonation, there's a lot of different things. You have to get the voice, you have to get the movements, and you have to figure out what would the person say. So if I just say something that the person already says, that's not an impersonation, that's an imitation. But an impersonation means you have to become that person and say, what would they do in this situation? You know, so you do, you know, what would Donald Trump be like, you know, shopping in the supermarket? You know what I mean? Then you have to do all the Trumpy lines and, you know. But that's an art form. That's very hard to do.
Yeah.
He says, Joe Biden, when he comes to the dramatic part, he starts whispering. Like this one impersonator, he says, Trump does the exact opposite. He says, what they're doing to our country, it's horrible. It's really horrible. I mean, they bring in all these people, illegal immigrants, and they're doing all these terrible things. They're murderers! They're rapists! That's very good. I never noticed that, but no. It's true. That's what he does, you know? So that's, to impersonate is an art form. But, you know, they say imitation is the greatest form of flattery, and there's no question about it. And that is, if when you impersonate somebody, that means you have to really get into it. I heard a story with Chassam Sofer years ago. I never checked it out. I'm not Pesach Kron, but where he was giving a whole drasha, and this kid knew him, and so he sat like down at the bottom where everyone could see him, but the Chassam Sofer can see him, and he was impersonating whatever he was doing and all of his movements and there, you know, there, like this. Chassam Sofer found out afterwards, he got very upset, you know. Okay, came to ask Machila, and he says, I thought about it. He goes, you must have been listening very closely if you were able to impersonate everything I was doing. You know, to be a good impersonator, you have to mamish. And that's why, oh gosh, on Saturday Night Live, the guy who did George Bush, Elder, I don't remember which one it was. It was one of these old SNL people. So he says, you can't do somebody if you don't like them. You can't really impersonate somebody, you know, because it comes out harsh. It's not real. If you like somebody, then you can get into their metzias, which is what impersonation is. Yeah.
All right. Take me to the meal. Take me to the meal.
Take me to the meal. Chalavchus. All right, so we'll wrap it up.
10-15 minutes. Take me to dessert.
All right, so the meal, you got to have kreplach. There was a time you could not buy it here. You had to make them yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can only buy kreplach in Israel before Hoshana Rabbah, Purim, and Yom Kippur.
Mm-hmm.
It's a seasonal food. I don't know why. I have a life I can't figure out. An American can get kreplach whenever you want. Now you have to be... You know, and I have to make my own prune hamantaschen, because they do not have prune hamantash in this country. They have chocolate. They have halva. They have strawberry. They have dates. But hamantashen comes in two flavors, either prune or mon, poppy seed. And no one eats poppy seed. Sometimes people pick it up by mistake thinking it's a prune hamantash. They bite into it. They spit it out. It's terrible. I don't know who eats it. I don't know why they make mon funds. I think it's just like as a party trick. But yeah. But prune hamantash, they don't have in this country because it's very hard to get Jewish food here. Mm-hmm. They don't believe in Jewish food. They have Arab food. But you can't get Jewish food, you know? Black cherry soda doesn't exist. You know what I mean? You know, cream soda. Okay. Cream soda, you know? Jewish food they don't have in this country. So they have Arab food. But hummus is not a Jewish food. It's not a Jewish food. Never was. Neither is falafel. These things are not, you know. Cold cuts. They don't know from cold cuts. They don't get it. But anyway, so I have to make my own prune hamantash. One year I couldn't even find prune filling. I had to make my own prune filling. Stayed in the freezer for a year and we threw it away. But anyway, so how much do you put into a hamantash at the end of the day, you know? But you have to have kreplach and you have to have chalavchus, which are stuffed cabbage, for those of you who grew up like me. Remember the first time my wife said, oh, look, they made chalavchus. I was like, what is that you're saying? you eat stuffed cabbage? You eat chalavchus, you know? But that's how I grew up. Anyway, so, and why do we eat those foods?
Because they're covered foods.
They're hidden. Mm. They're hidden. Everything is hidden. That's why the Mnei, I think it's the Mnei Soscha. He says,
he's my Shver's, the Ben Achabent of the Mnei Soscha. Yichus.
Your in-laws are German Hasidim.
That is correct.
That is a rarity.
Yes.
Shimsh before Hirsch with a strimal. You know, Shimsh before Hirsch never went to the mikveh. Maybe even Kippur, I don't know, you know. So one morning he's going to the mikveh. They go, Rabbi, you're becoming a Hasid? He goes, no, I was speaking with Gretz, you know, a student Gretz. I was speaking to Gretz, I have to go to the mikveh. Anyway, but he says on Hanukkah, you spin the dreidel because the hand is on the top. But on Purim, you do the garaga because the hand is on the bottom. So everything is hidden. So you eat food where it's hidden, you know. So, and that's why very often we'd also make the chicken bereka.
Well, till today, no?
Yeah, sometimes.
That's Purim.
Where everything is hidden. Everything's hidden, you know. My friend Yitzi Shapiro, he when it came out on a Friday, so you have to have Yisuda early, so he made pulled beef hamantash for the first meal. And the main course was Alka-Seltzer. Anyway, breakfast food of champions. Anyway.
And now, listen, you always... I mean, my hot shot, we always had the same guest. That was always the base. The Bears would always do it together.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And then you had the add-ons, whoever was around.
Well, when I had Talmidim, I said my Talmidim, that was...
Yes. And then just random strangers.
Yeah. That was when I was younger. When I was younger, this was a place that people would just come to after their Suda was finished or... when they realized their Suda was losers and they just come here. In fact, I've had many people over the years, relatives and people who come and are absolutely horrified by our Purim. They're just horrified because, you know, your mother grew up with a Purim Suda where the family sat around the table and had a Shabbos Suda. Mm-hmm. You know, that was the Purim Suda. They put out a bottle of wine, someone put on a funny hat, you know, and that was it, you know. And the insanity that went on over here, you know, where somebody would just suddenly walk in totally drunk with a guitar and start singing, you know what I mean? You know, and someone would come in and make a seum, you know, like there was all kinds of, and normal people would just look at this and they were like horrified. It was like, you know, who are these people and why are they here? Because I really don't know who they are. And they would pass out on the floor and, you know, very interesting.
And I'm rushing through this a little bit because of the time, but then it all came down to the end. After the dessert and after everything, you would always close the lights.
I forget about that.
Yeah.
I was young.
Yeah. Still till now.
You know, someone said to me.
You always used to give the story.
When I turned 60, people say, 60 is not old. And I say, I have a Beferish Mishnah that says not like you. Shishim Lezikna. That's what my Pirkei says. So clearly you're wrong. Shivim, you're very old. 80, we're surprised you're still here. That's basically what the Mishnah says, right? Shivim Laseva and Shmonim Lagvua. Like, I don't know how you made it. Anyway. Yeah, it's right. I forgot. Because, you know, I used to run NCSY. You know, we used to do kumzitzes. We'd sit down and we'd do a kumzitz.
And you used to start singing Kol Olam Kulo. And then you used to give the story. And at different breaks, everybody would sing. And there was a large crowd, a lot of people here. Very inspiring.
I forgot about that.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if I lasted.
I try to go back to my room as quickly as possible. Yes. Wait for the next heart attack.
Why'd you stop doing these?
I don't remember because I stopped teaching. So I don't have any talmidim, you know? And my kids, most of them live in Beit Shemesh. And so they have their own suthas. And so they just like stop in, like, you know.
Well, everybody comes. I mean, everyone comes.
They come, but it's not really Purim for them. You know what I mean? It's like they're just keeping the old man company, you know, as he sits there and goes, why are all the kids making noise? It used to be a lot of fun. It used to be exciting, you know. But those days, you know, when you're in your 60s and you're in your 20s, it doesn't matter who you are. It's only so much fun it's going to be. So either you're going to be Reb Moshe and your Talmidim are coming because they want to hear your Torah, you know. Or it's your kids who are coming by to, you know, just to see you and, you know, see how you're doing kind of a thing. But to have that sudav, that's something a Rebbe and a Talmud has. It's a different kind of thing, you know. So now, so who do I have? So it's like, you know, a few local kids, but nothing, you know. So like when your sister Mindy was here, she was always disappointed every Purim because she remembers hearing the stories of the old days. And now it's like we just sit around and like, who's getting the soup? I'll get this.
Listen, somehow every Purim, there's still the house is full. There's always guests. There's always people. Like
not like it was.
Okay, but I'm saying it's never. You're never sitting here on a Shabbos meal. You and some of your kids. I'm saying.
You know how they talk about the empty nest syndrome.
Yeah,
I always wonder what that's like. I can't even imagine. I know people whose kids like grew up and they got married and moved away. You know, and every Shabbos it's just them. You know, I imagine what that's like. So my parents, when they would go away to a resort, you know, so you had a choice. You could have your own table or you could sit like with couples and stuff. My parents always sat with the couples because they were a party waiting mm-hmm. for a place to happen. And when me and Ian would go away, we'd always ask for our own table. We don't want to talk to anybody. You don't have time to get away and spend time together. So it's a different experience, you know. One day we will be there. All right. Well, Yaakov Orlovsky. Back to the show with memories and embarrassing stories about Rabbi Orlovsky and growing up. I don't think
it was embarrassing. I mean, most of the stories were, you know.
Yeah, you left a, you know.
That's some of the worst part. This is how it was.
I have to find that old video, I guess, maybe, and put it on. I still have never seen it. I don't know what I looked like drunk. So, but
I think that was the one year that I don't think anyone else got drunk.
Really?
Because usually everyone gets drunk and then you get upset at the drunks and we have to try to remove the drunks and then whoever's left and whatever. And then that year you were just...
I just don't remember.
You were just out of here. You were sitting all day. It was, I think it was, maybe you had a, I don't know. I don't know when you started drinking. And a lot of people come in, they kept doing l'chaims. And by the time the meal came, you were ready like that. Everyone was on, you know, watch alert, like, okay. And halfway through, it was gone. And then, like, no one's going to start drinking now. It was like, okay, here it is.
I'm always high. So to get drunk seems to me like, you know. And often I'm a sad drunk, you know.
Well, not that year.
Yeah, that's why I don't remember. Anyway. But there is video evidence. So maybe, you know, like I said at the beginning, I don't want any hespedim, but maybe we'll show that. I'll finally have a chance to watch it and not be able to say anything, you know? You know, how much more embarrassed could I be? I'm in a box, you know what I mean? Like, you know. Anyway, so that's it for this week. we want to thank Yakov Orlovsky for coming back. And really, you should be a regular, you know?
Wow.
Terry Wogan, I think it is like the number one radio show in England. And my friend YY, Rabbi YY, was a regular on the show.
Oh.
It was just a secular show, but he would come on Ray YY because he's very entertaining. You know?
Yeah.
Well, Terry Wogan, I think. Anyway. So he
Joe
was
Rogan?
No.
I'm just okay.
Terry. I hope I remember correctly. I don't know. It's English. Right. Yes. But one time the Queen comes to Manchester and he goes, "Where's that Rabbi YY? I so enjoy him on the Terry Wogan show." So he saw it written up in an article. So he sent it to Terry, and the next day he was fired.
Really?
Yeah. So he called up his people. He says, "Why?" He goes, "I told you, it's Terry's show. If the Queen is asking about you instead of Terry, that's a problem." This happened with Rabbi Foya. I was speaking someplace where Rabbi Foya was teaching, you know, a little bit. Then I gave him a whole tribute. Then he was fired the next week.
Really?
Yep. But Baruch Hashem, Yaakov, you can come back anytime you want because I don't feel threatened at all. Because I'm a legend of my... I'm just the tens of thousands of people who follow this podcast and get chizik from it. And and you're a fan favorite, of course. You've been gone for too long. And this is a Purim one. We have to come back and talk about your new business and some of the amazing stories that come with that. And maybe we'll give a shout out, Notza.
That's right.
Can you find it online?
Of course. NOTZA.com. .co.il. I'm sorry.
Of all of your linens and...
Houseware. All the houseware.
Housewares?
Houseware. Yeah, I mean, like pillows, blankets, towels, sheets.
That's all called linen.
It's all called linen?
That's called linen.
A pillow?
Housewares means like pots, pans, you know, those kind of things.
All right, then.
Yeah.
Linen.
I'll have to bring your brother Shlomo on to talk about his Schleim's smoked meats.
Yeah, amazing.
Everybody's
very good.
Everybody's going off in different directions. And me, I do nothing. I sit here and I talk to you. So that's it. So everybody, Afreilich and Purim, and Yeshua's and the Chumas. And you know, there's two Adars this year, and we know that we put it in Adar Beis, so it's Semech Geula La Geula, and so the Geula of Purim should read to the Geula of Pesach, and we should be Zeicha to our Emesa Geula this year, and we'll have the Rabbi Orlovsky live show right near the Har HaBayis until Melech Mashiach comes and chases us away. What are you people doing here? Get out of here. No, they might get out.
No cameras. Shut the cameras.
Get out of here. What do you think you are? Anyway, so that's it. So if you want to find out more about the show, you can go to my website, RabbiOrlovsky.com, and you can send an email, you can leave a comment, you can download the theme song, it's the Rabbi Orlovsky Show.
Bum, ba, dum, bum.
I don't know, it's going to be a musical segment. Anyway, but...
I mean, you did it with every other guest, literally. I mean, every guy who came here got a singing portion.
Everyone gets a singing
except
part.
Me, yeah. Okay.
So next time you'll come, you'll sing some of your own compositions. Yaakov composes those songs. And you can sign up for one of our online shiurim. People are always signing up and joining the tefillah or the Misil Shasharim and Daf Yomi. So you have those options. And that's it. You can sponsor an episode. You can sponsor a question and answer. We didn't have a question and answer this week.
You could send money with no sponsorship.
Yeah, people do.
Mm-hmm.
They want to see this continue. I mean, it's not for me, you know. It's to be able to keep the show going. And eventually, when we have enough money, we're going to build the Rabbi Orlovsky Show studios and have a, you know, place for a live studio audience. And we'll have activities there. And some of my children will live there. Anyway. And that's it until next time. And so for now, I am David Orlovsky.
Yaakov Orlovsky.
And this has been the Rabbi Orlovsky Show.
It's the Rabbi Orlovsky Show. Torah and Simcha, ready to go. It's the Rabbi Orlovsky Show. Knowledge and wisdom will help you grow. Lots of fun in every episode. And we don't have to rhyme. No, we don't. It's the Rabbi Orlovsky Show.
on RabbiOrlovsky.com. Torah, anytime, YouTube, and more. It's Rabbi Orlovsky Show. Torah and Simcha, ready to go. It's the Rabbi Orlovsky Show. Till next time, till we meet again. It's the Rabbi Orlovsky Show. It's the Rabbi Orlovsky Show. It's the Rabbi Orlovsky Show.